What is the role of a governor's chief of staff, and what does it mean when you don't have one? From SDPB, today is Wednesday, June 12th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, Jonathan Ellis joins us for our Dakota Political Junkies conversation. We'll talk about organization in state government and how it impacts the governor's agenda. We'll explore the potential of an outdoor classroom designed to enhance Ocheti Shakoin essential understandings. Then when you call 911 for a medical emergency, a firefighter often gets to you first. Sioux Falls is searching for a fire medical officer for their team. Plus, wander through the rows of primordial corn, blown from glass, and speaking to modern ag. That's coming later in the hour. We're broadcasting live today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Well, imagine an outdoor learning space surrounded by native plants and grasses dedicated to Native American and South Dakota heritage. It has a little space for traveling exhibits, community events, and farm-to-table education. This is a newly announced initiative, and it's the Future Native American Heritage Outdoor Education Space at Renberg Elementary. It'll have another name in the future. The collaboration is between the Sioux Falls School District and the National Park Service, and Dr. Jane Stavem is superintendent of the school district and is joining me here in SDPB's studios, Kirby Family Studios in Sioux Falls. Welcome back, Dr. Stavem.
Thank you.
This is an exciting project with an interesting backstory. Tell me a little bit about the original idea behind this classroom and who's all around the table.
I love the table question because that's kind of how we're thinking about it, because as we continue through the project, we just know many people will probably sit at this table. But it came about over the course of years. This is just ending my fourth year in the district. The first time I ever went out to Renberg, it was like, wow, look at this backyard on this place. It's just this beautiful big green space. And so we've kind of talked about what else could we do back here? Well, then a year ago, we had our Native American honoring ceremony. I had been over at Eugene Field. They have a big garden project with a community partner. And one of the comments that was made during the ceremony was about the importance of what nature teaches us and how closely, of course, it's woven into Native American heritage and teachings and principles. And all of a sudden, my light bulb kind of went on like, oh, wouldn't it be cool if we could develop that space into outdoor education and specifically focus on our Ocheti Shakoin standards and try and build it around the special things about South Dakota and our Native American heritage.
What do you see it looking like?
That's the problem. Yeah. I can see it all in my head, but we're trying to blend gathering enough people and expertise, and our partnership happened at just the right time. Some folks from our Office of Indian Education were at a professional learning event and happened to meet this wonderful representative from the parks and national parks. And, oh, by the way, they live in Harrisburg. So we were able to kind of bring the right minds together at the right time. And what we're trying to do is craft enough of a vision for them, people to catch that vision with us, to then say, and now what do you think about this part of our space? And what else do we need to think about? So currently we're getting expertise in the design phase and trying to really capture some things about our standards with our OSO teachers. Even this week they're meeting to then say, okay, now here's kind of a big concept, and then we'll invite people to continue partnering with us. So, for instance, the farm-to-table aspect of it is we'll have a space for that, but then what's the what? What should we plant here, and what's specific to maybe a project that we'll then develop with our culinary arts kids over at our Career Academy and a chef who's an expert and go from there.
And when you talk about those Ocheti Shakoin essential understandings, there is an opportunity here for Native and non-Native kids to learn things like what?
Well, there's all kinds of pieces to that, from the actual, this is a plant and it was used for this purpose, and it might have been medicinal, it might have been a food product, to the way that people traveled across country and the preparations that went into moving with the seasons, or the actual items that might have been found along the way that were used or developed. I mean, so many things central to that. The four quadrants that are part of Native American heritage is something that we're working from, and I have to look at it to get it right, but it's that spiritual aspect. It's the earth and the components of earth, wind, fire, all those kinds of things. And taking that quadrant approach is something that we're maybe looking at. And right now we're just trying to figure out, how do we build it in so that it's alive right when you get to the space? Mm-hmm. And just by virtue of being out there, you get to learn, as well as then the, what are the things that you stop and learn along the way? And what are the teachable moments that we build into the space? So it's just being developed right now. And all of that is what we're kind of dreaming about.
Yeah. Jackie Wilbur at the University of South Dakota, who is one of our creators of our Teacher Talk blog at SDPB, went to Finland and was looking at the forest schools and the nature schools. Yeah. We just talked about that with her. One of the things that occurs to me is that even if we're trying really, really hard, kids don't naturally spend as much time outdoors as maybe when you and I were growing up, because there's a lot more to do indoors than
more distractions
we ever had, which can be a very good thing for education. It can also be a struggle. Do kids need a nature classroom in some ways to help them learn how to be in those outdoor spaces? What does that bring up for you as far as like what you're bringing into a school from kids who maybe haven't had a lot of time outside or a lot of safe time outside?
Well, in all of our schools, we're trying to look at, like, where are the spaces that we can just take learning outside, just to be outside. It's more fun outside somehow. Right. But also that experience of learning about outdoors and learning about all these different components. But I will tell you my own experience. When I was a teacher, we would take our sixth graders to a nature camp that was north of the school where we worked, and it was about a two-hour bus ride. And when we would get there, I would see kids that would turn into literally different people. They had such a different experience, and the freedom that kids have and the different way of learning and just how relaxed we usually are when we're outside. We're not encumbered by some of the same distractions. And getting your hands on something, we just know that experiential learning is great for kids. And outdoor classrooms are just one of the best ways. And if we have that in our own district, where our own students can go out and participate and just be part of that, we know that's a value add. But it's hopefully going to be a very special place, too, and one that has a distinct purpose in why you're there.
Yeah. What does that do for the educators, for the teachers, to spend some outdoor time?
Well, I said I need to fire myself and rehire myself because I want to write the curriculum, and I want to make it what we've talked about is making it so easy for teachers to be out there that it's not something that's a burden to prepare for, to, you know, have another ad. It's here you go. It's fun. It's easy. And kids are going to learn and not can't wait to get back out there. And so I think it will just be an easy place to go and to learn a lot, but to have a really good time with your students and have a unique time with your students.
Yeah. Say more about that. Help us understand what writing the curriculum, what goes into writing the curriculum. This is not a playground. A lot of planning goes into how a playground works, too.
Yes.
I will grant you.
It'll be next to a playground, which is part of the planning. Yeah.
But this is a different. How do you create a curriculum? What goes into creating that curriculum that can make the daily easier and more effective for teachers and
students? Well, part of it is, before you even step foot in the space, is there'll probably be some pre-teaching of, these are the things that you're going to go and do and experience, and here's how you're going to do that, from where your bus is going to drop off and where you're going to start your experience, to then how you move groups through the space, and how you organize groups of kids and where you're going to stop and where you're going to do something and then where you're going to regather. We hope to have kind of an outdoor classroom space to say, okay, now what did you see? And now go back and look at it this way. One example would be we've talked about you could go and have kids go through the experience one time just with what do you hear when you're here and what's the meaning of that. The next time is what did you see? Maybe it's what did you touch and feel? And then all of what could just go with that. So our OSO teachers are meeting right now because we also want to be really intentional about how we build those essential learnings in. Yeah. But then it's the how do you go out and guide kids through that? And that's where the curriculum part comes in.
OSO stands for?
Yes, Ocheti Shakoween Standards, yeah.
Okay. Jane Stavem, Sioux Falls, superintendent of the district, thank you so much for being here. We look forward to timeline here.
Yeah, we're developing right now, and so in the fall we hope to have kind of a roadmap for then how we do next steps and how we invite people to be part of the process. Parents, Renberg PTA, our Indian Ed office, the parents who are on their steering committee, lots and lots of hands are going to get to be part of this, so we're excited.
All right, we'll keep following it. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you.
Fire Rescue says more than half the calls they respond to are medical emergencies. And that is why the department just posted a new job opening, Fire Medical Officer. Assistant Fire Chief Mike Gramlich is with us now in the SDPB Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. We'll talk about the new position and the growing need that led to its creation. Welcome. Thanks so much for being here.
I really appreciate you having me.
I think most people know that if you call 911 often for a medical emergency, often the first people there are the firefighters, is the red truck. Why are you so positioned? Why are firefighters so well positioned to be first responders and medical calls as well?
Oh, yeah. Well, I guess you could argue that it's just a byproduct of the fire model. So obviously, the name of the game with both high-priority medical calls and fire events is proximity. You need to be there quick if you're going to intervene in a way that's meaningful. So fire stations are located, in essence, across the city, equally spaced. It makes it perfect for us to be that first response. So that's typically why you'll see us there first.
All right. So they're already trained to be first responders on medical calls. What is this new position? What does it bring to the department?
That's a great question. So Fire Rescue is predominantly BLS, so basic life certified, right? We also have ALS that we do in conjunction of the entire EMS model in the city. And for years, we've had both internal and external needs. So we have the internal health and safety of our people. We have the external needs to serve our public. So that EMS response as part of a larger system, right? Historically, we've kind of had those responsibilities meted out across several different areas to several different people over the years. This is our goal, is to have this one person to kind of oversee all of that with the credentialing and the history and the background to really bring us into the next stage.
Is this something that bigger cities have? What's the national model?
Some have similar models. Fortunately, or depending on how you look at it, unfortunately, the fire service doesn't have a lot of similars, right? A lot of places have different unique situations, so they try to find solutions for their challenges. For the city of Sioux Falls, we tend to be on the edge. We try new things. We are always looking for the better way to serve and to provide that service effectively. Even culturally, the fire services tended to be insular, right? We have folks that have come from inside. We try to do the best with the knowledge that we have. This role, we are specifically making that left-hand turn to go grab that higher level of expertise, that appropriate level of expertise. Mm-hmm. We want this person to be able to interface with our city health system, our local REMSA, like all of these areas where they're suited to be.
All right, let's talk about some of the internal care, if we will. How do you support firefighters through you know, wellness programs, through physical fitness programs, to make sure that they go out and come back safely because they're in shape to do their job. Help me understand what this role might do for the people who work for the department already.
Yeah, so the easy answer is yes, all of those things. Okay. But we're pretty fortunate. Again, the city of Sioux Falls has always invested not only in its firefighters, but its employees as a whole. So we're also fortunate in the fire service. There's the NFPA. So it's just a consensus standard that helps fire departments know what's best practice.
And we've so many acronyms.
I can't help it. Isn't it amazing?
ALS, BLS, yeah. NFPA.
This is my life all the time, right? Really just think of it as a consensus standard that helps us understand best practice. And we're really fortunate to have it because we don't have to reinvent the wheel every time.
Sure.
Sioux Falls has had that. We've been an NFPA compliant
organization. Which stands for what?
National Fire Protection Agency.
Thank you.
Yeah, there you go. most people aren't interested. It's an interesting acronym. But so that gives us guidelines. So from behavioral health to physical health to fitness. So we have all types of programs across Sioux Falls Fire Rescue. We work with an OCMED provider. So we have annual physicals. We're doing preventative testing. We do physical fitness both on and off duty. We provide nutrition support. We have an extraordinary array of things. But again, they've always kind of been meted out across several people.
Yeah.
Now we're grabbing somebody with the education and expertise to kind of help us manage that even more effectively.
And then for citizens, will they notice when a new person comes? Will there be changes? Too soon to tell for a lot of that, but what do you anticipate? Is there a vision here?
There certainly is a vision. It would be hard to tell what the crystal ball holds, but by taking it from, let's say, four distinct people and putting it into one consistent vision, it allows us to reach out into areas that we haven't had collaboration as easily with in the past. And when we start to see best practices coming in from other areas that aren't just fire profession specific, we'll be poised to implement those more effectively and quickly.
All right. Is there a type of person you're looking for?
Oh, wow. I think the easiest would be open to new things, wanting to try different stuff. We're a place that moves fast. We try a lot of different things. Change is pretty ubiquitous for us. So really, we're looking for that person who wants to try something different. And it's going to come by accident anyway, because we're really, this is a unique position. You don't see a lot of these advanced practice providers jobs inside of a fire department. Most people are looking at that clinical role or something similar.
Sure.
We're going to have a great mixture of things. So if you're looking for a fast-paced environment where you can do a lot of different things, I think this would be an exciting opportunity.
Talk a little bit about leadership in the department. This is something that you've, you know, as you come up through the ranks, have dealt with. This person will be in a leadership role. What are some of the ways that you consider leadership in the community and also in the department that you think would be useful for a new hire?
One of the practical benefits for us from this person being in our leadership team is that typically we have everyone has come from inside. So while there's some familiarity and there's some function to that, I'm really looking for that outside perspective. Similarly, we have, from a leadership and values perspective, the fire service has similar values to the medical field. So I'm excited to see that crossover and that patient-centered, patient-focused care from the start, but then also be able to bring that patient-centered, patient-focused care to our own team.
Yeah. How'd you get into this world?
To the fire service?
Yeah, tell me about how you entered this. We're always talking about recruiting and shortages and people moving from out of state to come here and do this job. Did you always want to be?
I never did. Mm-hmm. So it's an infamous story. I think it's actually on the city's website, hopefully for not much longer, but I had gone to law school and decided quickly that wasn't my bag. I had come home. I was waiting for my future bride to return home from her school as well. And my mom famously said that the fire department was hiring. And she was reading that out of a want ad to tell you how long ago this was. I didn't want to go. I wasn't interested. But I ended up going to take a test. And honestly, I just stumbled into it. And it ended up being the most wonderful, serendipitous, incredible thing. I've enjoyed my time in the fire service. I've been almost 25 years.
Wow.
And I hope that a lot of other people might stumble in as well, because it's a great place.
So you just say thank you to your mom.
I do. I have to all the time.
She
owns me on this one. It's really difficult. But yeah, I think she enjoys being able to hold that over me.
Yeah. What is the role of everyday citizens in providing emergency care to our neighbors? I know we had a training here and there was an app that once you go through some training, you can, you know, be connected to, you know, sort of a citizen Oh, response team. What do you want people to know about that before we let you go?
Yeah, absolutely. What you're talking about is Pulse Point. That's really the top of the pyramid for us. So Sioux Falls is one of a handful of cities across the country that uses Pulse Point. It's an app that will, if you sign up for it and you're certified in CPR or potentially using an AED, an automatic external defibrillator, it will notify you and you'll go help that person. But that's kind of the top of the pyramid. Okay. So there's fewer people there. It's the base of the pyramid that we want to focus on. I also currently serve as the interim director for Metro Communications. And honestly, that's where the rubber meets the road. So our dispatchers do emergency medical dispatch, which means they're capable of coaching anyone on the phone how to do effective CPR. And it's what we really need from people is just willingness. Mm. When you call and there's something going on, just be willing to intervene, willing to help out. We've got all of these amazing tools across our emergency response systems in the city. We just need citizens in the town that want to just engage, who want to be helpers, and we've put that into place. That's how you make an effective system, because we can only move so fast, so far. But if we can utilize people across our community to help out in that effort, we really can make save changes in the city of Sioux Falls.
That's how you build a community that 100%. You want to live in,
that
right?
is safe, kind, wonderful. Yep. Yeah, it's all about culture.
I love it. All right, Assistant Fire Chief Mike Gramlich, thanks for stopping by. We appreciate it.
Such a pleasure. Thanks.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I am Lori Walsh. For about a year, Governor Kristi Noem's office has been without a chief of staff. As of this week, well, that's still the case. Darren Seeley, the Bureau of Human Resources and Administration Commissioner, was named the new chief of operations in her office. He'll fill a role similar to the chief of staff, but he won't receive that title. There are nuances to this. So for our Dakota Political Junkies conversation today, we have Jonathan Ellis. He is the co-founder of the Dakota Scout and is with us in the studio. Hey, how's it going?
It's going very well. Thank you.
Let's talk a little bit about the history of this position, because Governor Noem has famously cycled through several chiefs of staff and now is saying, you know, I don't really need this position, but yet we are going to call this a chief of operations. What's going on here? What do you think we need to set this up?
Is this maybe the ultimate latitude promotion that you've ever seen? I don't, you know, I mean, it sounds like the functionality is the same as the chief of staff, which is kind of coordinating between the governor's office and other departments. So functionally, it sounds very much like what they would do. Why the title? I don't know. Perhaps she wants to be in a position to say that she's not losing another chief of staff in the event that Darren Seeley were to leave. I don't know. I'm not exactly positive. I mean, our questions went unanswered about the motivation there.
Okay. So he's also the Bureau of Human Resources and Administration Commission, which was a combination of two. And in her book, her most recent book, you know, she talked about shrinking the leadership of state government and said she was going to continue to make it smaller. You know, she combined Department of Ag mm-hmm. and Natural Resources. So this combining of roles is important to her. This seems like a lot of roles for Darren Seeley, though. There's a lot going on here. Are there thoughts about the effectiveness of this? Think back to previous chiefs of staff. I was reading Tony Van Huysen's history about this when the last chief of staff, Mark Miller, left, and what this person really does and how it's worked in the past. This is a change from what we've seen previously. Not a radical change, but an adjustment.
Yeah, I think if you're wearing the hat of the administrator over human resources, I mean, that's a pretty big job by itself. I mean, the mm-hmm. state is a huge employer. You know, you've got administrative issues. So, yeah.
They're replacing him, is that? Do you know that? Is he still doing all of this?
He's still doing all of this.
Okay, all right. Yeah. So it's an additional duties. Mm-hmm. Additional duties as assigned.
As assigned, right. Called latitude promotion.
We've all done that. Any feedback you're hearing from other people about this?
I have not heard any, but then I haven't been out there. I mean, it seems like it's an obscure issue for a lot of people. It's a political issue.
Yeah,
it's a political issue in the sense that politicians are always, whether Democrat, Republican, I mean, Kamala Harris has this issue. John McCain had this issue. that they are sort of criticized and ridiculed a little bit in the world of politics when they can't keep staff. And so that she's the butt of those jokes again, that she's not a good person to work for. So that's what some people would say. And those, you know, when you have constant turnover like that in that position in particular, but you know, other politicians have had the same issue. It's just something right. we in the political world kind of take note of.
We're paying attention. Mm-hmm. How about the pipeline for leadership? When I look back at then Governor Rounds, Chiefs of Staff, you see Neil Fulton in there for Governor Dugard, Dusty Johnson, Tony Van Huysen. These are South Dakotans who go on to do other roles in South Dakota, often in government, or Neil Fulton, Dean of the Law School. I think one of Rounds' Chiefs of Staff went to Poet.
I didn't remember Tony being a Rounds' Chief of Staff.
I'm sorry, what did I say? No, he's Dugard's Chief of Staff.
Dugard, yes, he was.
Yeah, and for Governor Noem. Yeah, I misspoke there.
Yeah, I mean, we had Mark Johnston, I think, was one.
Here's the list if you want
to. Yeah, leave it to Tony to come up
with. Tony Van Huysen.
To have this.
Hi. Thank you for your blog that helped put some of this into context for. But I guess my question, broadly speaking, mm-hmm. is when we see a governor who has many people who are from out of state, and then when they leave, whether it's in her communications department or in her, you know, assistant area, they leave, they go back out of state. Are we seeing what happens in the future for the pipeline of state government if you're not bringing those people in and if they're not shifting to other leadership roles in the state?
Well, I think there's still a lot of talent in South Dakota and South Dakota politics. You know, one of the reasons why I think she shifted after the first couple of years of her of looking out of state was perhaps the influence of Corey Lewandowski, who she met, you know, shortly into her first term. And she's always been sort of, quote, a fighter. And she wants staff that's going to, quote, be fighters. And in South Dakota, the political world is much gentler than it is sort of at a national level. And I think that's so looking out of state has suited her temperament, frankly.
Mm. All right. Amelia Joy, who was in her press department, has left mm-hmm. and moved on to a D.C. job. Maggie Seidel, does she still live in South Dakota?
She
when
does.
She first left, she stayed, even though she wasn't
She's still
originally
in South
from South Dakota. So does the departure of Amelia Joy say anything to you?
No.
Press secretary, she's going to America First Policy Institute.
No, I think that's a natural to move on to a Washington D.C. I mean, she's young, she's probably ambitious and wants to move up in that world. And when it's pretty obvious now that Chrissy Noem didn't run for president, and I think that B, her hopes of making the vice president selection are pretty dim at this point. And so, you know, for somebody who's ambitious, they would probably want to move back and be involved in more national politics.
Yeah, I think that's one of the questions. Does Amelia Joy leave after the book release and the press tour that went so wrong? This is her press secretary who has now decided to move to other things. Coincidence? Always was going to happen because these kind of jobs cycle in and out? Or was there an impact of that press tour that made Amelia Joy want to say, I'm going somewhere else?
I don't have any firsthand knowledge of that. And, I mean, her role as a press secretary was not, I mean, the press did not really have a lot of interaction with her. I mean, Ian Ferry, who's been around now for a while, is sort of the primary spokesman for the governor.
Yeah. And now what about this former chief of staff engaging in federal lobbying on behalf of the governor to a $120,000 contract? Tell me a little bit about what you know there. You wrote about this in the Dakota Scout.
Yeah, well, that's kind of an opposite situation. Yeah. That this was her longtime chief of staff. I mean, she had virtually no turnover in that office when she was in Congress. Jordan Stoick, she hired him. He's a South Dakota kid, South Dakota man. I guess he's older now, who was very seasoned already in the D.C. political world. He'd worked for a couple Congress people. He'd worked for a senator. And so in 2010, she's obviously new, incoming. She'll be an incoming freshman. And so Jordan is hired with his experience, and he ends up being the chief of staff and really guided the office until he left in 2017, when it was evident that Kristi Noem had said she was going to run for governor. So, he wanted to stay in Washington. So he went and was briefly at Treasury He was, you know, very easy to work with in my dealings with him over the years. Enjoyed working with him. He was very responsive. Mm-hmm. Then he left, went to Treasury, and then went and worked for the Manufacturers Association for a while as a lobbyist. He was the vice president of their sort of government operation there, and he was there, I want to say, for about 4 or 5 years before leaving, and now he's started his own firm, and one of his first clients is the state of South Dakota. And Governor Kristi Noem, it's unusual. It's not unheard of, but it is unusual for the governor's office to hire a D.C. lobbyist. Rounds, when he was governor, had done it briefly near the end of his second term, had hired the Bacarny Group, again, a group out of South Dakota, South Dakota ties. And Governor Dugard, eliminated that. Of course, he inherits a government that has a very, tight budget, and so that was an expense he eliminated, and they didn't have one again. So fast forward, more recently, last year, I want to say, they hired briefly for probably a specific issue, one firm, just for one quarter, and then more recently, they signed the contract in April with Jordan Stoic's firm.
All right. When a new governor comes in, does this all just change? About how often, through your years of covering state government, is this par for the course? New people come in, they reorganize, the org chart looks different, they bring in new people, the new governor comes in, it all changes again, or is state government largely kind of plodding and consistent?
In my experience, that she's made more changes than I think the previous two governors that I was around for, and even to some extent at Governor Janklow. So there's been, I feel like now, again, Tony might be able to correct me on that, but I feel like there has been definitely more change, the consolidation on those four departments, and again, new people that have been brought in. So yeah,
it's
hard to make government bigger
when the last governor has made a pretty big statement about her intentions to make it smaller. Mm-hmm. Sort of like raising taxes after you cut taxes, right?
Yeah,
it can be hard to sell that.
Be hard to do that for sure.
Be interesting to see in mm-hmm. the future. We haven't talked, you and I, since the primary, and a lot of incumbents were out the door. Any residual effect from the primary that you are still thinking about, especially in regards to the potential of voters having a say on open primaries in November?
Joe Kirby, who was on our podcast shortly after the election, was very forthright in the fact that he's got a lot of new friends among moderate Republicans, given the turnout, given what happened. And I do know that there have been some donations made by some fairly prominent Republicans that I think will show up in campaign finance reports later this year when that reporting takes place. South Dakota, unlike a lot of places, doesn't have as many reporting requirements, so we have to wait around. But I've heard some names that I think some people will be surprised by. So I think at the end of the day, I think it helped that effort. Will it be enough? Yeah, we'll see. But it definitely it was a positive for those who
helped
want it.
Some of the newcomers to this show who are listening now understand what we're talking about here. So the incumbents who lost during the South Dakota primary were not all moderates, but significant number of moderates got ousted by people who had sort of positioned themselves to the political right of those moderates, and they won. And so this effort to move into an open primary then is an effort by whom to do what? Because you're letting the Democrats and all the independents come in and vote on your primary, which some Republicans would traditionally argue against. Where is the push coming from?
Well, I mean, the argument is that the practical effect of this would be that more than likely the more extreme candidates are not going to win in the general election, that more moderates, let's say, and there will be a lot of races in which there are going to be two Republicans on the general election ballot. Mm-hmm. And there'll be typically a more moderate one, and that appeals to probably a broader share of the voting population than, somebody who's running in a primary election. The voter turnout is pretty self-selective in the Republican Party there, and that by that I mean that more conservative Republicans tend to vote in the primary. And so the effect will be that I think more moderate-type candidates will end up winning in general elections.
What are you hearing from Democrats? Do they want the open primaries too? Because the argument would be that if a more conservative, and that's a very broad term, candidate beat a more moderate Republican candidate, again, very broad terms, that might give the Democrat an opportunity to position themselves as a moderate compared to who came out of the primary from the GOP. I know we're splitting serious hairs today, but largely speaking, what is the Democratic Party saying about open primaries in South Dakota? Are they liking it too?
I think that they're on board with it. Now, there's some reluctance. I mean, I'm not all of them, but I think that they're going to be on board with it. They were reluctant in 2016 to remove party labels from races. But I think that they're on board with this one. I think that they recognize that there are some situations in which they will benefit. I mean, there are going to be many situations where there's not a Democrat on the general election ballot in some of these races. But I think that there is a recognition that there are some opportunities probably for them as well.
For listeners who don't know, you just came out of the Sioux Falls City Council with a win for the Dakota Scout as a newspaper, being the official newspaper of record for the city of Sioux Falls. We talked about the legislation during the legislative session that kind of cleared the path for that. So talk about now what that means for you going forward and for, you know, people who want access to those public and legal notices.
We don't start until July, the first week of July. That's when it becomes official. But we are actually our next couple print editions. They will be in our print editions as we work with the city on the workflow issues of getting the legal notices. So we're already going to start that. I think you will see a drastic the way we've designed this. Our designer, the way she's done this, I think you will see just a tremendous increase in the visibility of these in our print product. We will change our printing schedule a little bit. We print normally on Wednesdays. Now we will be printing on Thursdays to accommodate the city's schedule.
Okay.
So just a slight difference there. And, you know, the papers are still free in locations throughout the town. So there'll be no access, no payment access. They're free on our website. And then so there's no barrier there in order for people to access those.
So what are people going to find? These are public notices that include what?
Well, they include bids. Governments are required to put out bids for, services and things of that nature. And so there'll be bid notices. There'll be meeting minutes. So you can look through, like, what happened at this city council meeting. So you don't necessarily have to attend it. But you can get a rundown. The city has done traditionally a good job of keeping kind of more detailed minutes, so you can kind of get an idea of what happened at a meeting. So those kind of legal things that people, I think, who want to be informed, they'll have access to them for free.
Yeah. What does it mean to you personally?
More work.
You fought for it. You fought for this work.
Yeah. I mean, we'll see. We're in the process of the workflow issues and figuring that out. But I mean, I think it's obviously going to be a benefit for us. I mean, we will certainly look to also get the legals for other entities. In fact, I think Baltic named us their paper last night. And so for us, it allows us to, frankly, we're hiring. It will kind of be a revenue source of allow us to kind of expand, and that's what we want. I mean, I haven't taken a vacation in a couple of years. At some point, I would like to maybe go hiking in Colorado again.
Jonathan Ellis with the Dakota Scout. Thanks so much. We'll see you next time.
Thanks, Lori.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Corn is a familiar sight across South Dakota. Usually we see it in the fields piled high at the elevators or for sale on the corner from your local sweet corn grower. Well, from now until July 14th, you can also see 32 ears of 4-foot-tall blown glass corn in an exhibition installation at the South Dakota Art Museum. It's called Primordial Shift, and it explores Michael Milan's investigation into crop production, genetic food modification, and the ancient history of corn. Mick is a nationally known glass artist and Wisconsin farmer, and he is joining us on Zoom. Welcome. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Am I saying your name right? I got confused in my mind. So help me get it right for the rest of our conversation.
It's pronounced Mylan, and yes, I do go refer to as Mick.
Perfect. Most of the time, so. I feel much better now. Got twisted in my mind. So I'm in Brookings at this installation, and I'm completely enchanted by it. It's like nothing I had ever seen. Artists are not typically inspired by corn as a muse, but you are because of the connection you have as a farmer and as an artist. Tell us a little bit about how these two things intersect for you.
Well, first of all, I grew up on where I live now. I traveled and I went to college, and I just happened to stumble onto the art department, and it was very early in the glass movement of this country. It started in 1964, and in 1966, I took a class, the first class in glass, and it was very mediocre means at the time. The tools and how we learned to melt glass, all the techniques, were a real challenge, but because there was always this distinction of designer versus craftsman in the factories. And so it was always also an issue with the scale of the furnaces. So it was a real learning process for many of us that were early in this glass movement of contemporary art. So after graduate school, I was in the Peace Corps. I worked with Native Americans in Bolivia. And that's part of why I'm very fond of Native Americans. And it just so happens after graduate school, I moved back to the farm. Never really thinking I'd ever move back to the farm. But when I did, and I started making glass, it was in 1995 when I decided instead of making design work, I wanted to make something that I knew and understood. And that's when I started making glass corn, corn being the muse, as you call it. There's a lot to be said because it also is about genetic modification. And if we go forward to where we are today, it's a big jump, and it's just fascinating. This material called glass is juicy stuff that is alive when you're working with it. My studio is set up to make very large pieces. I have four seasons, basically. Spring planting, selling my work, coming back to harvest the crops, and then in the wintertime, creating the actual pieces.
Yeah. Tell people about, if you look closely at some of the objects and some of the pieces in the installation, there are these little glass balls with different colors which refer to the genetic modification, or it tells us something without telling us something. Help us understand what we're looking at when we see the cubes of dice or the colored glass balls that are attached to some of these ears of corn.
Well, the contemporary art means just that, the art of the day. And that has always kind of been in the back of my mind to make something that's current. Art is not always beautiful. And when there's, you know, the pros and cons of genetic modification. So my goal wasn't necessarily to tell as much as it was to force the viewer to kind of say why. And that is a really tough thing to do in art. But because of this juicy material, I created this large mold to make this corn, because it's sort of what Chaius Oldenburg always did. He takes small objects and make them very large. So by doing this, you kind of stun people when they first see it to say, okay, what does this mean? So when you get in closer to these objects, you start realizing there's little round spheres on some of them, and there's a decoration on them. It has to do with genetic alteration. What this means is that we can't see, we physically cannot see gene editing, So these objects are in there to tell the viewer that, okay, this is something different. It's not necessarily right or wrong. It's just that you're looking at something out of context. So you're adding creating a composition as a whole. So these things can be hung, you know, in any configuration, and they move. If you push them, it sort of looked for me, it's like the corn moving, a stalk of corn moving in the wind.
Yeah.
But they are to tell a story of where this came from.
Yeah.
And it's about my life as a farmer.
There's a sonic experience there. There's a video in the back where everything is kind of swaying, and it's very immersive, is what I want to say. I wanted to run through the. I did not run through the rows, because they're made of glass. Well, however, I wanted to, and I want to set this up for you, and then hear your thoughts on it, because part of my experience as a gallery, you know, someone walking in the gallery, is that I have. Because I'm from here, experience with corn. I know what it feels like in my hands. I know what it's like to walk through the stalks, right, or walk through the rows. And so immediately I am in the installation with you, and I'm bringing my own experience of delight and curiosity and memory and smell to it in a way. And I'm wondering what that brings up for you as the artist, to know that so many people are going to have that kind of experience, that you've added the senses for us, but yet we bring our own, and yet all of us will have different, because I'm not a producer, I'm not a farmer. So I have a different experience than a South Dakota corn farmer would come and have. What, when I say all that to you, is it a gallery goer? What does that bring up for you as the artist?
Well, that's what hopefully... that people do feel something when they walk in, because it's out of context, yet it's organized, it's in rows. I want people to feel that, especially farmers who drive back and forth in rows. Yeah. I mean, I relate to that immediately, because, you know, I mean, and that's also just taking on a different track, is that when we're out there in the field going back and forth, there's some monotony that goes with this back and forth thing. And that's a kind of a space for me to it's in that nowhere zone where I come up with these ideas. And I know for a fact that I learned early on, if you have to stop and jot down this idea. And oftentimes I had, you know, seed corn bags that had a tag on them, and I'd make these little drawings on them. And if I didn't do that, I would lose that idea. And so all of this stuff, you know, builds up, and then you play with a pattern design and see how you want to react with these things, and I'm finding that people do want to touch them. And it is, for me, a presentation of the grandiose scale of technology from beginning indigenous people to our current time. It's, I mean, we have made huge jumps from selective breeding, genetic alteration, and going forward to automation. I mean, and you start throwing in AI, and you have another whole ball game of technology that's going to really increase our yields. I mean,
we
are extremely efficient.
Yeah, I'm going to so much to talk about here. I'm going to jump in, because I do want listeners to know that they can see Primordial Shift at the South Dakota Art Museum in Brookings from now until July 14th. There is an artist reception Thursday, June 27th from 5 to 7 p.m. Artist Mick Mylan will be there, and we will have more from him, hopefully, in the future. Thank you so much for being here with us. We really appreciate this today.
Yes, thank you very much. I enjoy the show. Anyone who goes, it'll be fun.
All right. I look forward to talking to you again. For now, that is our show for today. Yes. We hope that it served you. From all of us at SDPB, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.